Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the re-election of Nancy Pelosi as the leader of the House Democrats, who beat back a challenge from Tim Ryan, a younger Democratic congressman from the heart of the Rust Belt who represents Youngstown, Ohio. Mark Sandalo, the Associate Academic Director of the University of California, Washington Program, and author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Life, Times, and Rise to Power, joins us to discuss the 134-63 vote and the age gap of the top three House Democrats, who are all in their 70s, compared to the House Republican leadership of Paul Ryan at 46 and Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, both at 51. With Trump's narrow victory over Clinton coming from the Rust Belt states, we will look into the change that the Democrats have become, the charge that the Democrats have become a party of the coastal elites and have neglected the heartland that used to be their blue-collar base. Then we'll examine the business reputation of Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, whose wealth appears to be derived from massive corporate welfare as a result of a vulture capitalist feast on the carcass of the 2008 Wall Street crash, after which Mnuchin bought a bailed-out bank for pennies on the dollars, then aggressively foreclosed on tens of thousands of families using robo-signing of dubious liar's loan documents. Syed Kashani, a lawyer whose clients included the largest private home builders in California and litigated extensively against Mnuchin's One West Bank, joins us. Syed acquired numerous private agreements between the government and the owners of One West through court orders and the Freedom of Information Act, and we will discuss Mnuchin's amazing raid on the U.S. Treasury that he will now be in charge of. Then finally, we will speak with Michael Gerard, the director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law and the chair of the faculty of Columbia University's Earth Institute. He joins us to discuss a new study by The Guardian and Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism's Energy and Environmental Reporting Project that finds the Obama administration's climate change legacy has been undercut by the administration's own U.S. Export-Import Bank, which poured billions into fossil fuel projects, erasing gains from Obama's Clean Power Plan and fuel efficiency standards. And joining us now is Mark Sandalo, Associate Academic Director of the University of California's Washington Program, who spent 21 years with the San Francisco Chronicle, including 11 of them as the paper's Washington Bureau Chief. He's the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Life, Times, and Rise to Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Sandalo.
Hello, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Mark. And this vote of 134-63 sounds like a comfortable victory, but it's being seen as a kind of encroachment, and if not a kind of bad sign for Nancy Pelosi's future. But she is I think 76 years old, as are the other two House leaders. And as I mentioned in the opening, the Republican counterweights to Steny Hoyer and James Clyburn, who both are 77 and 76 respectively, are much younger. So let's start with the age factor. Do you see this as a factor here?
I mean, it's not a defining factor in that, you know, Bernie Sanders, who's about the same age, was very, very popular with millennial voters. So it's not as if voters are not going to vote for them for that reason. And I'm not sure if it's fair to say they're out of touch, but I think the problem is they've been around for a long time. You know, I wrote that book about Nancy Pelosi. That was 9 or 10 years ago now, and she was riding the wave of being she remains the most successful woman or the most powerful woman in American politics in history. And she was seen as this completely different look. She didn't look like any speaker who, or even any Democratic leader who had ever come before them. You know, you think of the Tip O'Neills and the Jim Wrights, even the Newt Gingriches. You just had ever had somebody like Nancy Pelosi. So she was new and she was fresh and it was energizing. And the rap against her today, I mean, it gets conflated because some people say, well, we don't need a San Francisco Democrat. We need somebody from the Midwest. Maybe we need a white man. I think the real issue here, though, has moved on. The real issue here, and it relates adds to her age is that she's been around for so long. She's been Democratic leader since 2001, or in the Democratic leadership since then, and she's been the face of the Democrats. I mean, voters want change so badly in terms of the way the politicians act. They elected Donald Trump as president. You can only imagine how tired people are of the status quo. So to the extent that she looks like the status quo, I think that's the problem.
And her challenger is Congressman Tim Ryan, 43 years old, from Youngstown, Ohio, the very heart of the Rust Belt. And, of course, Hillary Clinton lost the Rust Belt rather narrowly by 107,000 votes, if you count Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. But they were the key states. And a lot of people have been scratching their heads in retrospect and saying, what happened to the Democratic Party in general? Weren't blue-collar industrial workers their base for decades? And how did Donald Trump peel them off?
Well, you know, they were their base, but it was a while ago. I mean, the last time that white people, forget about men, just the last time that white people voted Democratic for a president was 1964 in Lyndon Johnson. I mean, that's absolutely remarkable when you think about it, that, of course, it's true that there have been substantial number of white voters, I mean, enormous numbers, who have voted Democratic, and you patch that together with all the other pieces of America, and that's how Democrats have won elections. But if you look at even the Democratic members of Congress right now, the people who voted for Nancy Pelosi 2-1 today, and as you point out, winning with 2/3 of the vote sounds pretty decisive, but historically, you know, she definitely has more dissent now than she ever has faced in the Democratic caucus. But a majority of the Democratic caucus are not white men. They've got less than 50% of the caucus. I don't know, somewhere, you know, maybe 55% are either women or people of color. And the result is, you know, this push for we really got to get white working class men on our side as a political strategy is probably important, but that is not any longer the base or the strongest piece of the Democratic coalition.
Well, as it happens, white working class men statistically are still better off than their black or Latino counterparts. But nevertheless, it is a constituency that does feel abandoned. And frankly, I was astounded in the last week or so of the election when apparently Bill Clinton was tearing his hair out, wanting to go out and campaign in these very states that Hillary Clinton narrowly lost, and Robbie Mook and the people surrounding Hillary apparently were against the idea, and instead of addressing the very issues that Trump was addressing with very, very clever commercials that were all about the Rust Belt and about bringing back jobs, most of which I don't think are ever going to happen, but at least he was talking to them. And now Donald Trump is going to perhaps deliver 1,000 jobs from the Carrier Corporation that was about to leave Indiana for Mexico. Again, that may be a theatrical gesture, but it does show that somebody cares for them. And I just cannot for the life of me understand why the Democrats couldn't at least make that gesture. Given the narrow loss, may have made a difference.
And the interesting thing is, if you remember 8 years ago when Hillary Clinton was in that very bitter campaign against Barack Obama for the Democratic nomination, her base were exactly those people. I mean, Barack Obama was doing incredibly well with the well-educated elite whites and minorities and millennials, but Rust Belt working-class white Democrats were her base. That's why she won the Pennsylvania primary and kept the fight going against Barack Obama 8 years ago. But she was unable to do that this time. And it is remarkable when you sort of pull back and think about it. So who is it, if it wasn't Hillary Clinton, who championed them? You know, it's a self-proclaimed billionaire real estate mogul who's, you know, never lived outside New York City. And it just sort of it does speak, as you say, to the fact that at least he spoke to them, and she didn't. But, you know, she didn't speak to them in part because she assumed incorrectly in retrospect that she was going to win those places. And she was looking – I mean, essentially she was playing offense, trying to gain even more support in, you know, places like Omaha, Nebraska, where there was an electoral vote to be picked up, rather than playing defense in the very places you mentioned. And it turned out to be a calculation that cost her the presidency.
So that, given, I by the way, I remember, Mark, the famous video clip of her at a bar, at Hillary Clinton back in 2008 at a bar in Scranton, Pennsylvania, knocking back shots of vodka.
That's right.
And rolling his sleeves. He didn't have sleeves, but she sort of rolled his sleeves up. It was one of the guys, you know. In general, the questions are starting to arise, and this was basically the basis of Tim Ryan's challenge to her. You know, I'm from Youngstown, and you guys are the elitist on the coast, and all you do is raise money, and we know that California's become the ATM of the Democratic Party, if not the Republican Party, too, for that matter. Mm-hmm. You know, you've lost sight of the middle of the country. Is there a link to be made to Hillary Clinton and the woman that got into so much trouble and was finally kicked out of the DNC because of the Russian hacks revealed Debbie Wasserman Schultz's bias against Bernie Sanders and then Nancy Pelosi? Is that, do you think they're being conflated in a way that there's a kind of a group there that's insular and not really in touch with the working class?
I mean, I think there's no question that Nancy Pelosi lives in a neighborhood in Pacific Heights in California that is, I don't know what her house is worth exactly right now, but it's probably more than many of those blue-collar workers will make in a lifetime. It's a neighborhood that just is not in touch with that. But, you know, Nancy Pelosi does come from working-class roots. I mean, she grew up in Baltimore's Little Italy. Her father was the mayor, Tommy D'Alessandro. And it's very much a working-class neighborhood that she lived in, and she was very much in touch with those people. She's always been a very, very strong supporter of unions. And I don't think there's anything in her, you know, her pedigree, even if she's become very, very wealthy, that prevents her from speaking to those people. And what she needs are the issues. And right now, I can already see flashbacks to a decade ago when she partly took Democrats to the majority after George W. Bush proposed privatizing at least a piece of Social Security. And she told all her members, I don't want to hear any solutions coming from you or alternatives coming from you. Let's just campaign on the idea that we will save Social Security. No change. We will save it. And that took a lot of, you look at the struggle that Tim Ryan has had holding Tea Party Republicans and evangelistic Republicans together. Nancy Pelosi's Democratic coalition is much broader than the Republicans. When you start talking about Barbara Lee and from Oakland or Maxine Waters from L.A. and, you know, conservatives from North Carolina, and she held them together. And now when you start hearing talk that the Donald Trump's nominee for Health and Human Services is talks about maybe cutting back Medicare, and Tim Ryan would like to reform Medicare and change it. But already today in her comments after she was elected Democratic leader again, Pelosi was talking Medicare because this is bread and butter issues that people in Youngstown can relate to. They don't care if she's from San Francisco if she's going to save their health care for them. And I think that's going to be, you know, as much an issue as anything else. And you can see Democrats taking that up the same way they took up Social Security a decade ago.
Well, just in closing, Mark Sandilow, though, just the broader picture, I brought up the age difference. It does seem that the Democrats don't have a deep bench. They don't have a lot of young, up-and-coming leaders. A lot of the people they chose for the Senate, particularly in the key state of Ohio, just didn't make it, were just sort of retreads and were rejected. Now, of course, Hillary Clinton's coattails weren't very good. But in general, this is a party that clearly needs a wake-up call. It got a wake-up call in this recent election. But do you think the signal of business as usual, even with Nancy Pelosi, does feel in many ways like they didn't get the wake-up call? What's your take?
Yeah, I was thinking when she was elected in 1987, forget about this. There was no Facebook and no Twitter. There was no internet back then. I mean, this is a long, long time ago. She's been in part of Washington for a long, long time. Nancy Pelosi is a fiercely competitive, pragmatic backroom operator, and she will do whatever it takes to try to get Democrats to win. And if that means recruiting younger candidates, if that means, you know, playing with a message that appeals more to those kind of voters, you know, she will do that. You know, but as you point out, and of course, never polite to talk about these things, she's 76 years old. and she can't hang on forever. And if you realistically think the Democrats' best chance to take back the House of Representatives is after the next census, so we're talking after 2020 and the 2022 elections, well, she's well into her 80s at this point. And I think that she probably is looking around for somebody to groom as a successor. And I say this based on absolutely no inside information, because I've been wrong about this repeatedly. It would not surprise me at all to see her step away from, you know, the House or talk about not running for re-election next time. But I will, you know, I said that 6 years ago when the Democrats lost control and I was wrong. Maybe she'll be there, you know, into her 90s.
Well, Mark Sandilow, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Sandilow, who's the Associate Academic Director of the University of California Washington Program, who spent 21 years with the San Francisco Chronicle, including 11 of them as the paper's Washington Bureau Chief. He's the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Life, Times, and Rise to Power. Again, take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the business reputation of Donald Trump's choice for the Secretary of Treasury, Steven Mnuchin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Syed Kashani, who has practiced law in California since 1989, including with the preeminent Los Angeles firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, and later with the Wall Street firm of Shearman & Sterling. His clients have included the largest private home builders in California, and he's litigated extensively against One West Bank, owned by Donald Trump's nominee for the Secretary of Treasury, Steven Mnuchin. And he has acquired numerous private agreements between the government and the owners of One West Bank through court orders and the Freedom of Information Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Syed Kashani.
Thank you, Mr. Masters, and it's good to be on your show after listening for 20 years.
Oh, really? Well, thank you. And you may have missed the opening, but I framed this conversation, I think, rather harshly. We're going to be looking into the business reputation of Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, whose wealth appears to be derived from massive corporate welfare as a result of a vulture capitalist feast on the carcass of the 2008 Wall Street crash, after which Mnuchin bought a bailed-out bank for pennies on the dollar, then aggressively foreclosed on tens of thousands of families using robo-signing of dubious liar's loan documents. So correct me if I'm wrong, but elaborate if I'm right.
Well, first of all, let me say one thing. I wish President-elect Donald Trump well, and I hope that he can shake up Washington. But the way to do that is not to pick people like Steve Mnuchin. Donald Trump and his family made money through their own investments in real estate. Steve Mnuchin made his money through government corporate welfare. That's the only way to put it. The foreclosure issue that you talk about is in some ways the symptoms of how he made the money and not even the cause. Let me explain how this works. Let's go back in time. There was a legitimate bank in Pasadena called IndyMac Bank. This was a bank. It was not owned by Mnuchin at the time, and it made a lot of real estate loans, including home mortgages. In the real estate crisis in 2008, IndyMac Bank failed. It was taken over by the government regulatory body called the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC. Now, when IndyMac failed, it had branches, it had depositors' money, and most importantly, it had a very large loan portfolio of real estate loans, including about $11 billion worth of home mortgages that they had given out to homeowners. Now, Mnuchin and his partners, who were some former Goldman Sachs people like Mnuchin himself and other partners, including a fellow named John Paulson, who made a lot of money betting against real estate, et cetera. They approached the FDIC and entered into a deal in which they purchased Andy Mack Bank and the loan portfolio at a severe discount. Now, I wouldn't say necessarily pennies on the dollar or something like a 25 to 30% discount, but they bought it at a discount. It's not clear how much of that was cash. It's not clear how much of that purchase was financed by the government itself. And by the way, it's very, very difficult to find out what they paid. That's not very readily available information. Anyway, Mnuchin and his partners buy IndyMac, and they rename it. They set up a new bank, supposed bank called OneWest. OneWest Bank is still in operation. Now, here's the important point. OneWest Bank was profitable, and Mnuchin made money. But he did not make money because he's a brilliant banker. He did not make money even because he's a brilliant foreclosure artist. He made money because of the sweetheart deal they had made with the government. In the contracts between these buyers and the FDIC, the FDIC guaranteed to pay and did pay OneWest Bank up to 80% of any loss that OneWest Bank suffered on a loan they had purchased from IndyMac. Now, that's bad enough. You bought the loans at a discount, and you're being guaranteed against loss. I mean, that's bad enough. But the 80% is measured against the face amount of the loan. It's not measured against what they paid for the loan. So that's a recipe for success for the buyers of the bank. It's a recipe for disaster for all the borrowers and homeowners who got foreclosed. Let me give you an example of how this worked. Let's take a simple, basic home mortgage, $500,000, which is pretty typical for Los Angeles area. The Mnuchin and his group, through OneWest, they acquired this loan and many loans like it. They take the $500,000. They immediately go out and foreclose, which they did foreclose on many homeowners, and as many as they could. And let's say at the foreclosure, which ends up in an auction in California, they sell the house at auction for $250,000. Now, they bought that loan, $500,000, at a 25 to 30% discount. So let's say they bought that loan for $350,000. They've just foreclosed and sold the property at auction for $250,000. They go to the government and say, we have lost on this loan the difference between the face amount of the loan, $500,000, and what we got at the foreclosure auction, $250,000. We have lost $250,000. The government then writes them a check for 80% of that loss, $200,000. Now let's add it all up. They paid $350,000 for the loan. They foreclosed and got $250,000 at auction. Then they get another $200,000 check from the government. So they've made $450,000 cash on this loan, which they bought for $350,000.
But
now you multiply that. I'm sorry, go ahead, sir.
Well, I was going to say, though, in the broader sense, this appears to be profiting from other people's misery. What happens to the people that are foreclosed on? First of all, they got conned into these loans. I understand the paperwork was reconfigured with robo-signing, which should be fraudulent under any reasonable degree, but it wasn't. It was somehow they were able to retroactively fix the paperwork in their favor. And these people went from aspirants to the middle class to living in their cars.
There's no question about that, because the government's deal that they made with Mnuchin's group encouraged Mnuchin to foreclose fast and furiously, to foreclose as soon as they could and as fast as they could. There was no incentive to do the so-called loan modifications or workout or help homeowners stay in their homes. And the reason is this. Under the contract with the government, this sort of secret deal they made, and I say secret, I mean, it's possible to obtain the documentation, but very, very difficult. Under this deal they made, the loss is triggered when they foreclose. If the homeowner is still in the house, there's no loss, and they don't get that 80% reimbursement from the government. So obviously, One West had an incentive and did foreclose as fast as they could. And all of the factors you're saying not only happened, they're documented and found. An investigation by the Office of Thrift Supervision, or OTS, specifically found that One West employees had a habit of robo-signing, of signing fake affidavits, false affidavits, claiming they owned loans when they did not have the documentation that they actually owned the loan. Now, think about that. They're foreclosing on a mortgage they don't even own. And they're still kicking the guy out of his house. These were things that were found by the Office of Thrift Supervision against One West Bank while it was run by Munchen. There were also complaints that the incentives caused them to foreclose. And in fact, One West Bank, I believe, has the worst record in terms of working out loans or loan modifications or doing anything to help homeowners stay in their homes, because their whole incentive was built, the whole business model was built on foreclosing, taking the loss, and getting the money from the government. Now, let me just give you a total number here. In their first year of operation, One West Bank made $900 million. And we only know that because they had to report the information as part of the government stress test at the time. $900 million on a failed bank. Now, we don't know how much of that money was from these government reimbursements, but it's a fair bet that most of it was government reimbursement, because if you look at the records of other banks who were not foreclosing and did not have the government reimbursement, they were not making that kind of profit in their first year out after a failure.
Again, I'm speaking with Syed Kashani, who has practiced law in California since 1989, including with the preeminent Los Angeles firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, and later with the Wall Street firm of Shearman & Sterling. His clients have included the largest private home builders in California, and he's litigated extensively against One West Bank, owned by Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin. And he has acquired numerous private agreements between the government and the owners of One West through court orders and the Freedom of Information Act. So tell us a little bit about that. As much as I find this appalling that this man who's the Secretary of the Treasury has succeeded in this incredible raid on the Treasury, where he's just been able to get taxpayer money, fistfuls of it, at the expense and misery of others, and now he's going to be in charge of the very Treasury that he was able to so successfully raid. That's bad enough in itself, it looks as though the government, after the crash, built in these kind of perverse incentives. So, you know, a lot of people might be listening, might be saying, well, you know, he just took advantage of a government that, you know, somehow when Wall Street failed, they rewarded the failure.
Well, it's one thing, you know, I think Donald Trump at one point said that the real estate crash might be an opportunity to buy real estate cheap and make money. Okay, it's one thing to use your own money and go out there and buy foreclosed property and maybe make a profit, and your own money is at risk and you're taking the chance and maybe you make money and maybe you don't. But it's quite another to make a deal with the government that the government reimburses you for losing money and in the process foreclosing on these houses. I'm hoping myself, as a longtime registered Republican, I'm hoping that Mr. Trump perhaps was not aware of all these deals that happened before. And when his eyes are opened and he learns more about this information, perhaps he'll change his mind and pull this nomination. That's what I'm hoping, because the people who supported Donald Trump, I don't think expected him to bring in the ultimate Wall Street and government insider to be Treasury Secretary.
Well, the amazing thing is that he hasn't – there's not much on the record, but there is a news clip of him talking for CNBC, which is a very business-friendly network, as you know, where he basically said he's going to go after Dodd-Frank because he believes that the role of governments – the role of the Treasury is to encourage lending, banks to lend, not to – have too many compliance officers holding the back, that he really wants banks to lend. That's his pitch, and that he says that Dodd-Frank restrains banks from lending. But what you're telling us is the opposite, They actually turned these loans around and literally punished the people who'd made bad loans and rewarded themselves.
Well, it's not just that they rewarded themselves from the bad loans. They rewarded themselves with government money.
Right.
I mean, it's ironic that this gentleman who made his money from government largesse, is the best way of putting it, is now against government intervention in business. I mean, he made his money from government intervention in business. So this is not, I think Mr. Manchin's appointment is not consistent with what Donald Trump stands for and what Mr. Trump ran on. And I'm just hoping, as someone, as I said, who wishes Mr. Trump well and wishes the new president well and hopes he can shake things up, I'm just hoping he'll withdraw the nomination and go back and perhaps consult some of the people who suffered under the crisis and come up with someone different.
Well, but he's had plenty of time to figure out who Steve Mnuchin is, because Mnuchin has been his campaign manager. He's the big guy that's been out raising money for Donald Trump's campaign. So they've had a lot of interaction during this campaign season. And by the time you get to the hearings for confirmation of the Secretary of Treasury of Steve Mnuchin for the Secretary of Treasury, obviously, there's going to be some questions from people like Elizabeth Warren. I can guarantee that. But that's too late. I mean, the time for him to get educated is right now. And it seems like if he spent all this time with Mnuchin, he must already know. I mean, the guy comes from isn't he a pedigreed Goldman Sachs? He's almost a child of Goldman Sachs. His father was at Goldman Sachs. He then went into the family business, didn't he?
The entire, I don't know about family business, but I can tell you that the entire One West model is built on government subsidy. One of the investors in the group with Mnuchin that bought out IndyMac Bank, the failed bank, was a gentleman named John Paulson. John Paulson ran a hedge fund which essentially bet against the real estate market. And they banked that bet through a, let's call it an investment contract with a company called AIG. And the real estate market, in fact, failed, and Mr. Paulson, in effect, went to collect on his contract from AIG. But AIG, having written a lot of these contracts, couldn't pay. They literally did not have the money to pay. So Mr. Paulson and others who had bet against the real estate market through AIG stood to lose billions of dollars. What happened? Mr. Geithner, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, without any government authorization, without a congressional mandate, without any authority really from anyone, writes a $135 billion check to AIG. That money immediately went out the door to pay these contracts. I believe $5 million to Mr. Paulson's hedge fund, $5 billion to Goldman Sachs, $10 billion to a Swiss bank, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So right there, it's a government subsidy. And then Mr. Paulson turned around and takes that government subsidy money and invests it in another government subsidy, which is this IndyMac One West deal. So it's just amazing to me that these Wall Street operators who always talk about free market are the first and the last and the always to get government subsidies and basically corporate welfare. What this system is corporate welfare. It's not smart operators making money from their own business. It's not even, you know, a developer building a building and making money that way. It's people making money through government intervention.
And this is very much what Donald Trump ran against. He ran against the Washington insiders, the inside job. If ever there was an example of an inside deal, is the one that you just told us about, where Timothy Geithner, the head of the Fed in New York, writes $175 billion.
$135 billion
check.
The payment.
Right, and he presumably would have had to check with the Secretary of the Treasury at the time. But still, it's an extraordinary, and that was money was just passed through AIG to these other players, so that AIG could pay its bad bets. Right, and these guys bet against the house. They actually invested in the crash. Right. That was
there. Yes, they bet against the real estate market. They placed what you might say was a smart bet, but they placed it at the wrong casino. because AIG was the casino that banked the bet, and they failed. Incidentally, I mentioned that some $10 billion of that Geithner money went basically straight to Goldman Sachs. You mentioned the Secretary of Treasury at the time. That's another Paulson, not related to John Paulson, who was himself a former CEO of Goldman Sachs and whose portfolio consisted of some $900 million of Goldman Sachs stock. Mm-hmm. So the Treasury Secretary at the time oversaw a bailout of his own bank.
And nobody noticed, nobody said a peep, right? I mean, this is the amazing part is, are we to conclude that you've got to ask yourself, where do I get a deal like that? I mean, come on. The taxpayer, you screw up and the taxpayer bails you out, and then you get bailed out for hurting the very people who were conned. And, you know, the talk about the ultimate insiders, is that to say that does Washington run this country or does Wall Street run this country, do you think?
Well, look, I'm not getting into big philosophical issues
okay. Here.
I mean,
all right. Well, no, you don't have to.
Coming from the point of view of someone who, again, you know, hopes that Mr. Trump could bring a change to this, it's very disappointing that his first most prominent appointment is an ultimate insider who profited from the government intervention and rigging that Mr. Trump ran against. That's disappointing.
Mm-hmm. So what would you want then? I mean, as I say, by the time a lot of what we're talking about is aired in Senate hearings from critics of Trump, particularly, I imagine, Elizabeth Warren, it's too late. What would you hope is done at this point?
I think every homeowner who lost his house or whose mortgage is in default or has problems paying his home mortgage, many of whom I believe voted for Donald Trump with hope and reason that Donald Trump would make a change, if all those people got together and communicated their concerns with Mr. Trump or their senator to congressman, whatever, and said, look, this is not what we voted for. We didn't vote for Donald Trump so you could bring another insider back in as Secretary of the Treasury. Please pick someone else. That could go a long way because it's the very people who voted for Donald Trump who really, in many ways, suffered under this scheme that Munchen was a part of. And I want to emphasize something. I say scheme. There was nothing unlawful about this. It's distasteful, but it was nothing illegal, and maybe that's the worst part about it, is that this arrangement was a lawful arrangement. It's not an illegal arrangement. And maybe that's the saddest and most disappointing part, that nobody broke the law in getting all this government money in return for foreclosing on thousands of people.
Well, Syed Kashani, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Syed Kashani, who has practiced law in California since 1989, including with the preeminent Los Angeles firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, and later with the Wall Street firm of Shearman and Sterling. His clients have included the largest private home builders in California, and he's litigated extensively against One West Bank, owned by Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, and he acquired numerous private agreements between the government and the owners of One West through court orders and the Freedom of Information Act. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the Obama administration's climate change legacy has been undercut by the administration's own U.S. export and import bank. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Gerard, who's a professor of professional practice at Columbia Law School, where he teaches courses on environmental law, climate change law, and energy regulation, and is the director of the Sabine Center for Climate Change Law. He also chairs the faculty of Columbia University's Earth Institute and has written or edited 11 books, including Global Climate Change and U.S. Law and the 12-volume Environmental Law Practice Guide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Gerard.
Thank you.
And the U.S. Guardian, along with the Columbia University School of Journalism, have put together a study, and it is pretty alarming, that pretty much indicates that all of the gains in terms of President Obama's climate change legacy are going to be weakened by, you know, the same government, in effect, has, with what one hand has given, another has taken away in terms of the import-export bank in the loans that they've given to fossil fuel and coal, oil, and gas companies have basically offset the gains, if not set us back. So how could this situation have taken place? Did President Obama not notice?
Well, we don't know if the gains were entirely offset the way you said, because some of the loans went to projects that would have happened anyway. It may have been that some of the loans provided for U.S. technology that was cleaner than would otherwise have happened. But there certainly is the phenomenon that at least some of the gains have been overtaken. Some of the gains through the Clean Power Plan and President Obama's other measures have been, you know, negated by the loaning of U.S. money for fossil fuel facilities abroad. And I think there is a little bit of the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing. Also, most of these loans were in the early years of the Obama presidency before he adopted his climate action plan and started getting much more vigorous on fighting greenhouse gas emissions.
But just to lay out some of the statistics here, that since January of 2009, the U.S. Export-Import Bank has signed almost $34 billion worth of low-interest loans and guarantees to companies and foreign governments to build, expand, and promote fossil fuel projects abroad. This is three times more the financing than the taxpayer-backed bank provided to George W. Bush's two terms, and twice the amount financed during the Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton administrations combined. And since 2009, the Export-Import Bank has financed 70 fossil fuel projects, which will push 164 million metric tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year, about the same output as 95 currently operating coal-fired power plants in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Oklahoma. So pretty alarming statistics.
Yes, it is quite surprising to see the result of this study done by the Columbia Journalism School and The Guardian, that the sheer magnitude of the loans that went to some of these very, very large fossil fuel facilities. The U.S. is no longer allowing the construction of big fossil fuel facilities within our borders, but there's a lot going on abroad, and we see that the Export-Import Bank has helped that along.
And some of these projects that the U.S. taxpayer has indirectly financed are a natural gas plant on an island in the Great Barrier Reef off Australia, which incidentally is dying off as we speak, one of the great wonders of the world, two of the largest coal mines on the planet, a dozen refineries and petrochemical plants in countries like Saudi Arabia, India, and Turkey, and so on. So is this a case, though, of where the U.S. government, through the Import-Export Bank, is loaning money to foreign projects, and the pollution that takes place abroad is not attributed to the United States? Is that a part of the kind of left hand not knowing what the right hand's doing?
Yes, under the international climate law regime, the emissions that are attributed to a country are only those that occur within its borders. Not those that are attributable to what it consumes, even if it's made abroad or what it has financed. So none of these numbers count toward the emissions reduction pledges that the U.S. has made in Paris and elsewhere.
So again, I'm speaking with Michael Gerard, who's a professor of professional practice at Columbia Law School, where he teaches courses in environmental law, climate change law, and energy regulation. He's the director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law and chairs the faculty of Columbia University's Earth Institute, which I understand is pretty much on the chopping block, isn't it? At least NASA's Earth Institute, which I take it is a part of Columbia.
Well, we're affiliated with some research programs that receive federal money. The Earth Institute itself is certainly sure. not on the chopping block, but some of the there are reports from various sources in the press that the incoming Trump administration is going to reduce climate research. But as with many of these things, we don't know what's really happening.
But again, since 2009, 7 of the U.S. Import-Export Bank's 10 largest deals went to oil and gas giants. ExxonMobil, BG Energy Holdings, now part of Royal Dutch Shell, the Australian Pacific LNG, which built the terminals on the Great Barrier Reef, and Pemex in Mexico, that's got an awful lot, $1.3 billion in loans. So is the argument then that had they not loaned this money, somebody else would have loaned this money? The idea that the U.S. taxpayer under an administration dedicated to taking on climate change against a lot of resistance from the part of the Republicans, many of whom, including their key committee heads, are global warming deniers. So is this a case where if they wouldn't have done it, somebody else would have done it? Or would it have made a difference if the U.S. would have taken a stand and let the world know that it's not going to finance these kind of projects?
We don't know that. We don't know whether some of these projects were marginal and couldn't have attracted the financing otherwise, or some of them would have been built or not been built. What we do know, the purpose behind the Ex-Im Bank is to encourage the export of U.S. technology. So we do know that these facilities almost certainly would not have been built with U.S.-made equipment. Whether they would have been built at all, we just don't know.
But that is contradicted, though, the idea that we're supposed to help U.S. exports. Apparently a lot of loans, in fact, $540 million, went to Turquoise Hill Resources, a Canadian mining company, to buy equipment from Japan's Komatsu, which is a direct competitor of Caterpillar.
Right. And so the details of these loans is something that I can't address and that don't necessarily have a greenhouse gas significance.
Sure. But that does seem to contradict the intention of helping U.S. manufacturers if we give loans to companies that buy equipment from the Japanese, which they could have bought from the U.S. So we know that the Republicans have been complaining about this bank for some time, and they made an issue of it in some of the budget showdowns. So that's a kind of peculiar situation, is it not, where the Republicans are screaming corporate welfare, and the Democrats are defending this bank.
Yes, this is a reversal of the usual picture that we see. We do know that Bernie Sanders also opposed the continuation of the Export-Import Bank.
So what do you think?
So the Democrats were not entirely united on this either.
No. But what is the situation now with its future? I mean, this report from Columbia University's School of Journalism and The Guardian, I was struck by it. It's the lead article at The Guardian's website today. It certainly got my attention, and I imagine it's got President Obama's attention. He must be very uncomfortable about this, surely.
Yes. Now, of course, the decision on its future is no longer in his hands,
right.
And what the next administration will do is completely unclear.
But is it likely that you think this report will add to the momentum on the part of the Republicans, including one of their key senators who's been trying to get rid of the bank?
Well, the Republicans, by and large, don't care about climate change or greenhouse gases, the ones who are leading Congress, as opposed to in the general population, many of whom do care about it. But what this might do is reduce some of the Democratic resolve to try to fight to keep the Export-Import Bank in operation. If there is a clear showing that some of this has negative effects. As I said, most of these loans are loans that were given in the early years of the Obama administration. In the later years, they've adopted the policy of no longer financing coal mines abroad and so forth. So the real question would be, in terms of the future of the bank, what are the future loan policies that they have, and will they be environmentally negative as well.
So it's Senator Richard Shelby is the Republican senator that's been trying to kill the bank, but the defenders of the bank, of course, say it's self-sustaining, returns its surpluses to the Treasury, which were about $280 million in 2016. So let's then talk a bit about the real issue here, Michael Gerard, and that is climate change and the extent to which the irony, of course, with this report that we're talking about is that the administration that's really tried to raise the public's consciousness about climate change has also, in effect, been cutting itself off at the knees, whether perhaps even unwittingly, through this financing via the U.S. Export and Import Bank. But let's go with the positive part of it, the trajectory, if you will, of what Obama has tried to do, and now that there's a radical break and most of his legacy is up for grabs, particularly his signature issue of Obamacare, what do you think is going to happen to climate change, given the signals already, as we talked about a little while ago, that NASA's research funding for climate change research is likely to be slashed?
Well, in 2009... Donald and Donald Jr. and Eric and Ivanka Trump signed on to a full-page ad in support of strong climate action. But more recently, Trump has come out in the other way and has had various tweets calling climate change as a hoax. Many of the people who are advising him on these kinds of issues are, like him, climate deniers, which does not bode well for the future of climate policy in the U.S. He has said that he would withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement. He has said that he would kill the clean power plan, all of which he could do. And this would be a major, major setback to efforts to fight climate change. We don't yet know what the real story is with climate research. There's a great deal of good that is done by it, and we'd hate to be in an ostrich situation where we just don't want to know the facts. But clearly, in terms of climate regulation, it looks like the Trump administration is going to be a major, major setback.
Well, this apparently is not just a problem in the U.S., although I think the rest of the advanced world is much more receptive to the science, and the issue is settled. I think we're the only country that even still entertains the debate that there's another side to global warming. But
The U.S. Republican Party is the only major political party in the world that, as a matter of doctrine, denies climate change, and Donald Trump will become the only world leader who denies climate change.
But there was, of course, an element within the Australian government, a conservative part of it's actually called the Liberal Party, but it's a conservative party. They recently were going to kill off an important research station in Tasmania, which is apparently the most important research station in terms of measuring the effects of climate change. And there was a global outrage from the scientific community, and now they've put back some of the funds, not all of the funds. So is that an indication that there is a way to overcome these denialists by a kind of global consensus and a kind of public relations campaign? And naming and shaming, I guess, maybe what it's going to come down to.
Right. I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon that in the English-speaking world, in the U.S. and in Australia and in Canada, we have political fluctuations back and forth, and some governments are very much in favor of acting on climate change and some are opposed to it. One would ordinarily think that that global outrage would have an effect on the U.S., and traditionally it has, as it has on many other countries. But Trump seems to pride himself on annoying other countries. So we don't really know how that's going to play out, but I think it's certainly important that the supporters of climate research be very vocal in expressing in any way they can the importance of continuing that kind of research. It's just essential to understand natural systems and what's happening.
But you mentioned earlier the full-page ad that Donald Trump and his kids took out, and the children, particularly Ivanka, apparently are considered some of his closest advisors. So there is obviously a detectable pattern here of Donald Trump either being completely confused and, you know, sort of lurching about as a kind of reckless amateur. That's one way to look at all the contradictory remarks and tweets and and policy statements and leaks that come from the Trump transition. But there's also another explanation, I guess, which is that he's sort of using this tactic of being for and against something at the same time as a way to throw everybody off. And I don't know whether are we going to find out whether this is a game or whether he is for real in either one way or the other. Either he believes in the full-page ad he took out warning about the danger of climate change, or he is this latter-day denier, as he's now claimed to be.
Well, he's repeatedly said that he likes to keep people guessing, and he's really good at that. He's been very effective at keeping people guessing. And, you know, many people feel he doesn't have strong convictions on these issues and is influenced by the people around him. We don't know how his children feel about climate change. They haven't spoken up on this, so far as I know. But he's bringing into his administration a lot of people who have been very adamant climate deniers, and that's not a good sign. Well, he has not yet appointed the head of the EPA or the head of, or the Secretary of the Interior, which are two extremely important environmental positions, and the identity of those appointees will tell us a lot.
Well, the transition head for the EPA is a global warming denier.
That's right. Martin Ebel has for many, many years been a dedicated and vociferous climate denier, as has Stephen Bannon, the counselor in the White House, and several others.
Well, I guess it sounds like it might be a question of the last person that he spoke to, and the ranks of the science-based realists seem pretty thin, so I guess if you want to bet, it doesn't look good, right?
Well, eventually EPA is going to have to make the actual decisions on what they do with the Clean Power Plan. Do they go forward with it? Do they make efforts to rescind it? Do they make it clear they're just not going to enforce it? A policy is going to have to be adopted, and presumably over the next several months we'll know what it is. If it is the policy of denying it, that'll be very bad news for a long time to come, because of course the greenhouse gases stay in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. I think regardless of which way it goes, we'll see a lot more action at the state level. To a certain extent, this resembles the Bush-Cheney era, where in the absence of any federal action on climate change, a great deal happened at the state level. California, in this case, as in most such cases, led the way in 2007 when a Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, signed a very, very important climate law. 10 states in the Northeast adopted the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And so I think we'll see that kind of activity again, but it's not going to be enough. It won't be at the scale that is necessary to solve the problem.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Gerard.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Gerard. He's a professor of professional practice at Columbia Law School, where he teaches courses on environmental law, climate change law, and energy regulation, and is the director of the Sabine Center for Climate Change Law. He also chairs the faculty of Columbia University's Earth Institute and is the author of 11 books, including Global Climate Change and U.S. Law and the 12-volume Environmental Law Practice Guide. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side, sign up for iTunes podcasts, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.